Bala Radhi Govinda Bala
Ah, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is so lovely to be with you for our sixth class in Loving Your Way to Awakening. It is our final session for now, but as you know, this transmission will go on cooking within you for as long as you let it, and even after you've forgotten the specifics. And I really do encourage you, by the way, to listen to these classes several times, because the feeling that's coming through you, that's coming through them, will be there. And I also want to say that I have some ideas about what's next, and we'll talk about that either later today or in a newsletter, in a letter. So let's find ourselves a comfortable posture. Let's find ourselves on the shores of the lake. And as we sit around the lake, the deep blue lake of consciousness, which takes this form of loving waters, have this sense that we're all sitting together around it. And don't forget to invite people in your life that you would like to share any form of love with, affectionate love, passionate love, familial love, appreciative love, sweet love, forgiving love, whatever. Invite family members, friends, people that you actually in real life have a little bit of a problem with. Feel that all of us are sitting together here. And let's just take a moment, bring our hands together, bow to the lake, and bow to the circle. In your cupped hands is a tea light, and you perform your magical gesture of lighting it, and then holding it in your hands, make an intention. And my suggestion is that this intention be for how you want the insights and the feelings and the inner experience that has uplifted you in this time together, how you want to bring that into your life, or simply to have the intention that it remain and grow in your life, which honestly I promise it will. And then place the candle on the lake. Your eyes are closed. Your breath is flowing softly. You're actually receiving the breath of love that's present in this gathering that flows from the lake itself. And as you allow yourself to take it in, see if you can let it kindle the heart space. And we'll chant the mantras to the Guru in the form of pure consciousness, the mantras to Krishna, the icon of devotional love in the Bhakti Sutras, and the mantras to the goddess. First, three Aums.
Chaitanyam Shashvatam Shantam Vyomatitam Niranjanam Nara Bindu Kalatitam Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangam Langayate Girim Yat kripatamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Sarva mangala mangalye shive sarvatra sadike sharanye triambake gauri narayane namostute. Om. In the fragrance, the aftertaste of the mantras, with the sense that you're breathing in the subtle fragrance of love, imagine that there is a being watching you, perhaps through the window of your house, watching you sit in meditation around the lake, seeing you as an embodied form of spirit, holding you in profound appreciation. This being is aware of your beauty, of your struggles, of your fear, of your resistance, of all the subtle permutations of pride and greediness, all the things that you're ashamed of, your existential suffering, everything that is part of your karmic incarnation, as well as of your growing spiritual realization, and feel that this being is loving you. Feel that this presence loves you not only for the beauty of your essence, but also for all your cute qualities, your personal eccentricities, your silliness, the parts of you that are a little bit obnoxious. And be aware that this being is not imaginary. This being is the witness of your life, the lover who is both inside you and outside you, whose form, if form is the right word, is pure awareness and love. And letting yourself feel held in that loving presence. Begin to notice the path of the breath as it flows into your nostrils, flows up, touching the soft palate, inhaling upward to the space of the third eye, and then stretching that space so that your inhalation ends in the heart. Exhale, feeling the breath rise up and flow out the crown of the head. The inhalation flows in, touches the soft palate and the third eye space in the center of the head. Stretches downward so that your heart is included. And then the exhalation very softly and gently flows upward, outward, simply dissolving in the space of this inner body that is being created by this practice. Inhaling, touching the soft palate, touching the third eye, stretching down to the heart, allowing the exhalation to open this inner body, to fill it with prana. the heart of the bhakti path is that it's personal. It really is about the divine that knows your name, that knows your struggles, that knows your aspirations. And that doesn't mean that you have to be the devotee of a particular personal form of spirit, or even an unabashed believer in a personal divinity, certainly not of Krishna, Jesus, or a goddess. For many of us, presumably for most of us, this is certainly true for me, the beloved is formless. You know, a feeling of the field around you, an energetic tenderness in the heart, a sense of presence at your back, or awareness of the invisible knower who's present with you, like that lover peering in through the window. And in the case of the beloved, probably telepathically trying to remind you to turn around and notice her. And, of course, revealing itself, herself, himself, through the eyes of other beings, other humans, or your dog or your cat or a deer, or the words of great poets, or the devotional energy that you can feel in great music, even when it's not specifically devotional. So when I say it's personal, I mean that it meets your personal self, your personal incarnate self, your small self, as the texts of the Indian tradition say, meaning not only your soul, but also your personality, everything that makes you the unique individual that you are. The personal form of divinity is right there with you, in all your guises and all your disguises, not demanding that you be a great meditator, not even demanding that your love be constant, but simply present, always. The personal form of the divine, the path of the personal, really celebrates us in recognizing spirit as something, someone that you can relate to as an invisible friend, as a hidden lover, as the mother who is able to love you in the way that your human mother probably couldn't, at least not all the time, and who also happens to see through our structures and hesitations and ultimately reveal that she's within us, that she's in every cell of our body. So in the paradigm that many of us are familiar with from non-dual Shaivism, bhakti is what's characterized in that tradition as a dual, non-dual path, meaning it starts in duality. Me, devotee, you, divine beloved. Me, small individual soul, you, great supreme soul. And as it deepens, it starts to morph into that state where you actually do have moments of realizing that there are not two. There's not an inner and an outer. There's not a lover or beloved. There are ultimately no forms or separations, where you begin to sense that presence inside and outside. So in the non-dual Shaiva metaphysics, it's said that the absolute, which is one, which is vast, omnipotent, undifferentiated, radically intelligent, utterly in love, creates within itself a separation so that it can experience love, so that it can be in love with different forms. And in the metaphysics of this tradition, which whether we see it as mythological or metaphorical, the original separation is between the two sides, the two halves, as it were, of the formless absolute, which the Shaiva tradition calls Shiva and Shakti, or light and awareness, or consciousness and bliss. And this initial separation is for the sake of joy, for the sake of play, and eventually morphs into a let's say, a pull, a draw to become many, to experience what in that state is an ecstatic realization of itself in zillions of forms. And it's always for the sake of joy, for the sake of play, for the sake of experience. And in the realization that's described on this path, on this dual, non-dual path, liberation or awakening involves both the enjoyment of two-ness, of separation, of many-ness, and the merging back into oneness. Eventually, that enjoyment becomes constant. And, you know, if you read the writings of the great beings, you see that many of them are describing how they'll go into this utterly non-dual state, an utterly often formless samadhi state, and then come out and enjoy love through other devotees or through food or through nature. Because duality, which is such a source of suffering for most of us, has become ecstatic. I believe that we carry in our soul not only the undying presence of love, but also the knowing that this experience, this ability to experience the world as both ourself and as a beloved other, it lives in us, that it's calling us, and that all the discomfort and suffering and confusion that we experience in normal life just seems to be part of what drives us into the arms of the beloved. That's the game. I think that's how it's set up. And I do believe that this is a very beautiful way of describing what we human beings are here to do, to, as it were, join heaven and earth within our own bodies and within our own circle. And there's a good reason why so many of the great non-dual realizers, including Ramana Maharshi, of course Ramakrishna, and even that ultimate non-dualist, that hardcore take-no-prisoners non-dualist Nisargadatta Maharaj, were all devotees of particular forms. They all were in love with a personal form of the divine, and they all practiced worship. So bhakti is a yoga, and it's based on what I think is one of the most profound truths about the nature of mind, the fact that the subtle creative energy we call our mind, is a personal form of the great mind, and that because the innate mind energy is so profoundly creative, so utterly able to manifest in different ways, whatever we deeply focus the mind on will give shape and form to the mind and turn the mind into an instrument of deep knowing, deep confusion, attachment, freedom. Really, the mind can become anything through our focus. And when we love something or someone, love becomes the quality that defines the mind for as long as we dwell in that loving. And of course, when that loving is tinged with attachment and woundedness and all the other stuff that our human self projects onto it, the loving will be tinged with pain. But gradually, over time, as we come to realize what we're loving, and as we allow ourselves to be, as it were, purified, love will eventually dye your mind in the color of love. And I notice that there's quite a few moments on the listserv when people are expressing that feeling of being dyed in the color of love. So it's very accessible, although not always, although we move in and out of it. But there's another subtle mystical truth, that it's a gift of the path of love, and it's that ultimately, when we love, we recognize eventually that it's spirit that loves through us, that it's love itself that loves through us. And somehow that recognition cures the feeling that we often have of not being good enough, not being worthy, not loving enough, not being capable of what the great mystics seem to incarnate. And eventually, over time, our consciousness gets cooked, it gets pickled in that recognition, so that even when we're not aware of it, love begins to shine through our actions and our words and to flow through our energy field. So all the different flavors of love, appreciative love, clinging love, the love that we feel in a group like this where it feels like a kind of cloud that holds us all, love filled with drama, passionate love, the love that breaks your heart over injustice, love that just feels really, really good. All these flavors of love begin to reveal themselves as flavors of the one love. But, of course, we do need to choose wisely where we direct it. So here's what Rumi has to say about the power of love. Really, he's talking about ecstasy itself, which, as you know, is one of his great subjects. God has a dark wine so potent that drinking it, we leave the two worlds. God has put into the form of hashish a power to deliver the taster from self-consciousness. God has made sleep so that it erases every thought. God made Majnu, the legendary lover of Sufism, love Layla so much that just her dog would cause confusion in him. There are thousands of wines that can take over our minds. Don't think all ecstasies are the same. Jesus was lost in his love for God. His donkey was drunk on barley. Drink from the presence of the saints, not from those other jars. Every object, every being is a jar full of delight, but be a connoisseur and taste with caution. Any wine will get you high, so judge like a king and choose the purest, the ones unadulterated with fear or some urgency about what's needed. Drink the wine that moves you as a camel moves when it's been untied and is just ambling about. What does he mean by the camel ambling about? I believe what he means is that the true wine, which is love, of course, creates in you a natural, spontaneous surrender. One of the truths that the great beings like Rumi offers us is not that we should only love holy people or holy places or the formless divine, but that we should let all our loves take us towards freedom. In other words, we should love the ecstasy itself and not that which triggers it, not only that which triggers it, and learn to give up the attachment that binds us and keeps us from fully feeling our freedom. And, of course, that's the journey because it's the nature of human love, the nature of a human psyche, to become attached to what gives us even a glimpse of ecstasy and to be afraid of losing it. And it's when we become willing to look very carefully at what we love, in those we love, that we become willing to look very, that we begin to comb out the threads of clinging that tie us to past wounds. And I think for many of us, the wound is in the receiving. You know, we haven't really received enough love from other human beings so that we can trust it. And this is one reason why the practices that we've been doing of actually breathing in love from the universe or feeling the presence of that being who's watching us lovingly are so important on this path, asking, is there any love present? But for this moment, for right now, let's let ourselves be instruments of love. So focusing on the breath, bring your hands together in the center of your chest, not in Anjali Mudra, but, you know, in a sort of gesture, the gesture that you would make if you were pulling your chest open. So you're literally opening your chest wall. Of course, this is imaginary, but it's a very powerful gesture. And feel that you're letting the love inside flow out to the circle. Holding your chest open, I'm seriously asking you to do this with your hands. Inwardly say, may the love that is present in my heart flow out to all of you. For some of you, that may be, you know, a kind of assertive, like you're going to beam it out. For others, it may feel like it's a kind of a soft mist. May the love that is present in my heart flow out to all of you. And what's going to happen as we do this is that the love that's flowing from you is going to meet the love that's flowing from everybody else. And you can have the feeling that with the inhalation, you're drawing it in, and with the exhalation, you're offering it back. Like a figure eight or an infinity sign, it flows from your heart to all of our hearts, and from all of our hearts to your heart. Were there thoughts that arose as you did this practice? Were there hesitancies? Did you just feel that you flung yourself into it? Did you wonder if what you were experiencing was really love? Just notice how the bhakti path offers us the opportunity not only to connect in this very open-hearted way, it also gives us the opportunity to notice what hesitancies arise. And so devotion will purify you moment by moment, time after time, just by recognizing that love is flowing towards you and that love is flowing through you. You know, as I think many of you know, devotion doesn't have to be a big to change your life. You just actually need enough interest, enough willingness, even to get a tiny glimpse of it. Bhakti is simply the inclination to love and the desire to see all forms of love as forms of God, no matter how veiled. And to give yourself, I like to say give yourself a discount, just give yourself, accept the fact that the way you love right now is the way you love right now. The way you receive love right now is the way you receive love right now. Maybe very big, maybe feeling, you know, small and contracted, maybe bringing up tears, maybe making you laugh. And the other thing I want to say, and because we've been talking so much about God, is that to be on the bhakti path doesn't mean that you have to believe in God in any conventional way. This is really important. You know, I've been reading a book about a woman's cancer journey. It's actually a great book called Grace and Grit by Ken Wilber about his wife's kind of amazing spiritual path through illness. And a lot of it is her diary. So she starts out, as many of us do, as a typical post-religious modern person, spiritual but not religious, with an allergy to what some of my friends call the G word. And at one point, she's practicing meditation based on her own provisional and tentative recognition of that presence that she refuses to call God. And the words that she finds that will let her work with the idea of benign, transcendent presence are this. She says, "I consent to recognizing the presence of spirit." So notice how much hesitation there is in that. You know, I consent to recognizing the presence of spirit. Not I recognize the presence of spirit. I'm willing to recognize the presence of spirit. And that's how it starts. You know, in the end, as time goes on and her practice deepens, her mantra changes and she's inwardly saying, "I surrender to God." Because when you start to recognize the presence of spirit, a lot of things happen. And ultimately, one of them is the recognition that there's something you can trust, that it's leading you, and that you might as well become like Rumi's camel and just amble about in that state of allowing, of surrender, of acceptance. Our relationship to the bhakti path will often start as a feeling of wanting to move towards more love, or just as a sense of dissatisfaction with your life, or maybe as, you know, real active suffering or despair. So it can start out in a very experimental or transactional way. Krishna says in one of the famous verses of the Gita that there are four kinds of devotees who turn to God. And the first three kinds of devotees are all of us. So these are the suffering, the ones who are desperate, sick, oppressed, or just dissatisfied, the worldly, the seekers of truth, and the wise. And I want us to just examine what that means, because they're presented as a kind of a hierarchy, that all the first three are kind of lesser, and that the one that really matters is the wise one. But Krishna says very clearly several times in the Gita, and I think you've probably realized by now that I do take the Gita as the unvarnished truth spoken by God at a particular era in history, but mostly truth, mostly really deep clues as to what works on the path of enlightenment. So for the suffering, you know, the ones who are desperate, who are sick, who are being tyrannized over by the circumstances of their life, or just dissatisfied, you know, we are realizing that life is painful in ways that we never could have imagined, and that we really need some help. And so in this state, we turn to God for help, for comfort, for some way to feel better, maybe only half believing that it will come or that it will help. But that turning is the first step to devotion, and it's what sustained millions of people for millennia. You know, Karl Marx wasn't wrong when he said that religion is the opiate of the masses, but it's a darn good reason why we need religion. You know, just the way opiates make pain go away for a little while, so does chant and prayer and ceremony and turning to God makes our difficult lives feel less difficult. And everybody needs that, especially people who don't have much else, which is all of us when we really get right down to it. So the second type of devotee is the one who turns to God for help in worldly life. And this is the kind of one of the paradigms that's at the heart of the Gita and of all Indian spirituality. This is called rajasic devotion. And this is how me, certainly, and I'm assuming many of you got started on this path. So speaking for myself, you know, when I got into spirituality, I was in my late 20s. I wanted to get better at life, meaning I wanted to have more enjoyment, more joy. I wanted to have a better functioning ego. I wanted to have better relationships. I wanted to be able to do the work that I loved without getting totally stressed and second-guessing myself. And I didn't even have a conception of deity or higher power. It was a technology of spirituality that interested me. And even after I had had an awakening, including an awakening to love, which really did transform my life, I still would only turn directly to God when I was stymied on a project or when there was something I needed to get done and I didn't feel powerful enough to do it myself. You know, I'm talking here about prayer, about having a prayer practice, which I do believe is, you know, what really at the heart of the bhakti path, some kind of way of dialoguing or talking to the God being. So my prayer practice actually started when I was Baba Muktananda's press secretary. I would pray that an article would turn out favorably for him. I would pray that, you know, people in the media would take me seriously when I said he was a great teacher. And when I made mistakes, I'd pray that nobody would notice. This is actually the very height of Rajasic devotion, by the way. So one of the big turnarounds for me happened when I was stymied on a creative project. I'd been asked by New York Magazine, actually, to write an article about my experience with Baba Muktananda. And in those days, I really thought that my role in life, my reason for existence was to somehow be a messenger for the transformations that he caused in people's lives. But I've been trying to convey this language, this experience in language that a normal person could understand, and I had totally failed to do it. So one morning I did something that I had never done before. It's a prayer I recommend. At least it works for me. I prayed with a strong sense of urgency to my guru's guru to give me the power to write this article. And what I said was, I can't do this. I've failed again and again. I'm not going to be able to complete it. If you want it done, you'll have to do it. And this prayer, which I literally realized was a transactional request, if you want this done, you have to do it. The result was literally miraculous, at least for a blocked writer. I sat down at the typewriter, and it just came out. And it was in a perfect New York Magazine voice. They published it. A lot of people came to see my guru as a result. So that Rajasic transactional prayer was actually the first step in the ongoing journey of recognizing that I am not the doer of my actions, that something else is working through me, and that if that something else does not work through me, that nothing works. The third kind of devotee is the one who's motivated by interest in truth. This is the seeker, the one who's been bitten by the bug of spiritual aspiration, and a lot of you are like that. A lot of people on the contemporary spiritual path are like that, though I think all of us have the first two types of devotion in us as well. So, and you know how it is. You read about these experiences. You meet people that you know who've meditated and who have changed in powerful ways, and you want that too. Or maybe you're just interested in comparative religion. You know, you get intrigued by Tantra or Yoga or Vedanta. And at a different stage, maybe you've been doing a practice like Vipassana or Zen, one of the practices that are more awareness-oriented, and you're feeling a lack, you want to get your heart involved. So this is what leads you to investigate a heart-based practice and to begin to strive for devotion. So this is when you begin to ask, you know, to realize that at the level of truth, your own activities are not going to cut it. It's the same, you know, thing that I experienced in my Rajasic writer moment. You realize that you can't storm the gates. You can't, you know, you can't force heavens to open to you, as it were. But if you connect to a personal sense of source and begin to explore that in a loving way, that you actually will begin to experience wisdom arising in you. What you may notice is that these three types of devotion form a kind of hierarchy, like Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, it actually corresponds almost directly to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The suffering soul is focused on survival needs. The worldly soul has their survival needs taken care of. They're more focused on success and achievement, in making something of themselves, at changing the world, you know, at making a difference. The truth seeker is motivated by the need for self-actualization. Yet, you know, and all of these motives are part of our palette. For most of us, there's a comfortable oscillation between these three forms, and they're part of what it is to move on the path of divine love. You know, we start with very, very human motivations. So the fourth type of devotee is what Krishna calls the wise, and this is the devotee that Narada celebrates most brilliantly in the Bhakti Sutras. What Krishna means by this is people who have directly experienced the full truth-laden potency of spirit in a form that is both personal and impersonal, you know, that both is a being who they can love and feel love from, and also as the all-pervading awareness, the formless, non-dual presence that is the source of the universe. So we're going to talk towards the end of this class about the sutras that describe this kind of devotee. What the fourth type of devotee is experiencing is called parabhakti, or supreme devotion. It's the devotion that arises as the fruit of our practice of bhakti. What we're doing is practicing bhakti. And, you know, because there's so much grace in this path, in our practice of bhakti, it starts to arise in us. But the ultimate fruit of it is all practice dying away. And this immersion in what the great beings have described as the ocean of ecstasy or the ocean of love. So what we're doing is cultivating the heart. What love is doing is, as it were, seeping up or bursting forth through every opening that we create through our cultivation. So gradually we get into the habit of opening, of being willing to let go of the veils. Some of the veils we really hang on to, especially the ones that feel good. And we learn how to do it so that we can actually allow the grace that is the active aspect of love to start to remake us. And maybe we don't realize what form grace is coming in. We might be looking to our right, having a particular idea of how it should come, when actually grace is showing up in a completely other way. I mean, for me, the classic example is of when, you know, of people who are sick, and I've been this myself, praying for healing. And with all the prayers, we're still sick. But somehow we're being nourished with the strength to deal with it, with insight that comes as a result. When somehow illness has made us value the beauty of life in a way that we couldn't before. So it's a little bit like that story. I can't help telling this story. It's a story you probably all know, but it's so true. You know, there's this guy, you know, this story of the guy who's caught in a flood, and he climbs to the roof of his house, and he begins to pray, God, rescue me. I depend on you completely. You are my everything. And as he's praying, a rowboat comes by, and the guy in it says, come on, get in. I'll take you to higher ground. And the man says, it's okay. God's going to rescue me. God is my all. God is going to rescue me. A few minutes later, a helicopter comes by. Come on, grab the rope. We're lowering this rope. We'll pull you to safety. no, it's okay, God will take care of me. So the water is rising. It ultimately drowns the guy. He gets to heaven, because this is a Christian story, and he meets God, and he says, why didn't you help me? And the voice of God says, what do you want? I sent a boat. I sent a helicopter. Why didn't you take them? So just let's take a moment with this great question. How is grace present in my life this week in ways that I do not or did not actually notice? So how has grace been present in my life this week in ways that I don't necessarily notice? Just ask yourself this question and don't think about it too much. Just see what arises. So with that awareness, let your attention come back to the breath. Sense the inhalation flowing up through the nostrils, through the nasal passages, touching the soft palate, entering the third eye space in the center of the head, stretching down to the heart. So see if as you're listening to me, you can allow this process, the inflow of the breath through the nostrils, touching the soft palate up to the center of the head, and then the sense that the inhalation stretches your attention to include the heart, and then the exhalation flows through your body, front, sides, back, and above the head. And see if you can recognize the evolution that you've gone through in, as your ability to connect to spirit becomes more trusting and more mature. Noticing that you may have become more comfortable over time asking for help. Or noticing that on your path to self-actualization, towards becoming a better person, you really are looking at questions like, who am I and what is this life really about? And beginning to feel that this transpersonal source of intuition that is beyond your small mind and which will always give you insight if you approach it in a way that connects. So consider how you have in small ways, and maybe for many of you, very big ways, begun to trust that there is grace, that love is actually the strongest force in the universe. Bhakti, like all spiritual, what would you call it, attainments, like all spiritual developments, is actually developmental. This is very much a start where you are path. You know, whether what you're looking for is relief or a boost for your life or to be, if not the most enlightened kid on the block, at least one of them. All of these forms of devotion are really important because they'll all take you forward as they'll all help you develop And that said, the devotion of the truly awakened ones is of a different order, because their devotion has this exclusive nothing else matters passion that the rest of us are only able to feel part of the time. So that's the passionate devotion that Kabir and Rumi and Mirabai talk about, and which is what we catch when we read their work. You know, it's because they're in the world and they've left records of their experience and their poetry that we actually have windows into that state. And it's that passion that powers this course. It runs through this course, because once we start opening the door to the path of love, it kind of doesn't matter who we are. Love is going to start moving through it and into us. One of the things that these beings tell us is that the more we want love for its own sake, the deeper and faster love becomes not only available to us, but living us in a way that really changes everything. So this is what Hamid Ali, A.H. Almas, has to say about it. The inner journey is a love affair. It has nothing to do with getting things done with your life in the world. It is entirely about a relationship with God. Our focus is on our relationship with God, the source, the supreme spirit, the self. That in itself is awakening. Actually, the word he uses is enlightenment. That in itself is enlightenment. I mean, that is a pretty powerful statement, to recognize that when you're focused entirely on your relationship to God, you're enlightened. What allows us to dive fully into the ocean of love, this is me now, the love that lines the inside of the universe, is our growing preoccupation with being in relationship with God, in a love affair with God. You know, our relationships with others are both a template for it, and they also, God knows, are the arena where we learned love in the unconditional way that Narada describes. You know, we practice love with each other, but what Narada says is that to experience real ongoing union, it eventually needs to become so important to you that you are willing to let go of everything else when there is a choice. You know, when there's a choice, you're willing to give up the other stuff for your relationship. So your partial devotion will bring you close. It'll give you glimpses. It'll hopefully increase your longing. And it will make your life way better. So it's a path with no downsides. But at a certain point, when the longing becomes longing to feel God's presence no matter what, that's when the experiences of the sages becomes your experience. And here's Almas again, making the hardcore statements. The difference, he says, between your relationship with God and every other relationship of your life is that God is never going to change for you. You have to change to come close to the beloved. It's always you who has to accommodate the beloved. The beloved does not accommodate. No negotiations, no compromise. Only 100% surrender. You have to want to surrender 100%, or you will usually be shown the door. Regardless of how you define the beloved, this is the gist of every spiritual practice and teaching. Now, let's be clear that what he's talking about is what it takes to fully realize the divine self through this path. You know, when your devotion is of the first three types, when you're on the path, in the process of spiritual maturation, as all of you know, we get many chances You know, you fall off the horse, and if you can get back on, the horse is still going in the direction that you want to go. You know, it's really very similar to how in meditation, for a long time, you keep getting distracted and remembering, getting distracted and remembering. And every time you get distracted, you are shown the door. You know, you're out of meditation. You're in a mind state of some kind, or aware of your physical discomfort, or, you know, all the stuff that is part of our ordinary way of being. So at a certain point, you no longer want to be shown the door. And that's when your whole journey becomes about learning surrender, 100% surrender. It's thank you. It's gradual. Very rarely does it come on you all at once and demand instantaneous surrender. And we've talked about this earlier in the class. When it does, normally we fall back. Here's how Kabir describes it. The bhakti path winds in a delicate way. On this path, there is no asking and no not asking. There's no asking and no not asking, meaning we're emotionally pointed so deeply in the direction of the divine that there's no need to ask for grace, and yet our entire being is a prayer. So Kabir says, on this path, there is no asking and no not asking. The ego simply disappears the moment you touch him. The joy of looking for him is so immense that you just dive in and coast around like a fish in the water. If anyone needs a head, the lover leaps up to offer his. Kabir's poems touch on the secret of this bhakti. If anyone needs a head, the lover leaps up to offer his. You know, when you have this truly intense longing to be close to God all the time, that longing itself impels the evolution of your consciousness. It literally pulls you forward. And when you aren't following the pull, it can literally hurt. It can physically hurt. When I first began awakening to the beloved in the heart, I would start experiencing a burning in my upper chest, a kind of delicious pain that absolutely demanded attention and that drove me to meditate even when I didn't want to. So it seemed to be calling me to pierce into it, to enter it. And unless I did that, unless I was willing to enter it, it would just go on eventually kind of torturing me, and I would get irritable and, you know, out of sorts until I sat and joined with it. And it was in trying to enter the heart, it was in all those meditations where I explored and attempted to pierce through that burning that I discovered the door to the back of the heart that opens when you enter into it and let it take you where you want to go. Because what happens when you surrender to the pull, in whatever way the pull is coming, is that your desire starts to guide your inner practice. You actually start to make choices, maybe not even deliberately, they're just happening, that will let you stay present to the burning sweetness in the heart. And when you lose it, maybe it's not burning, maybe it's soft, maybe it's expansive. We all have our own way of experiencing it. But when you start to lose it, you begin to feel a kind of desperation to get it back. And the strength of the beloved's presence starts to lead you, whatever your ego feels about it. I've had, as I'm sure many of you have, I've had knockdown, drag-out, energetic fights with that presence. When I, meaning my ego self, wanted to do one thing, and the inner pull wanted me to be present with him, with that, with her, to turn inside completely in moments when my attention was elsewhere, including moments when I really felt like I had something I had to do and I didn't have time, I didn't have space. But the pull would literally drag me inside. One of the reasons I love Teresa of Avila is because it took her so long to stop fighting with the pull, to let go of desires and distractions. Teresa of Avila, who was one of the great devotees and one of the great teachers of contemplative Catholicism, describes in her autobiography a period of her life when she was living in a fashionable convent in her hometown. You know, in Catholic Europe, there were upper-class convents where nuns would come with their dowries, and it was chic for the local nobility to visit the nuns for conversation, which also included flirtation, a lot of philosophical conversation done in a, you know, in a very flirtatious way. And Teresa had become quite famous as someone who was really good at these conversations. And she had a relationship with a local priest of her own social class who was, you know, a very courtly and gallant and attractive person. And he would come several times a week, sometimes every day, and they would spend time together, she behind her grate, he in front of it, but with a lot of emotional intimacy. And simultaneously, she was having some of her most amazing spiritual experiences, including that very famous one, you know, which Bernini, the great Renaissance sculptor, 17th century sculptor, Baroque sculptor, made a statue of Saint Teresa with a spear in her side, because in this experience, Saint Michael pierces her side with a spear of light, and she begins to have ecstatic trances in which she would sometimes levitate. She would be in radical raptures. But at the same time, she was very attached to her friend. And she lived in this very human conflict between erotically charged friendship and the radical ecstasy of her divine lover. And she said that she had come to take Jesus' love for granted so much that she felt like she could, you know, kind of let it be there while she pursued her other interests. So this struggle raged in her body for years, and she actually stopped praying for a while because she felt so guilty about it. Eventually, she was drawn to, you know, genuine one-pointed attention to her inner self. But her willingness to go through that struggle and to share it in her autobiography was part of what made her one of the great spiritual teachers in that tradition, as well as an extraordinary activist who founded several order of nuns and monks, and which gave her a power that let her defy the Inquisition and do her work despite enormous suspicion and opposition from the church establishment. So the thing that we get from her story, one of the many things we get from her story, she was also a fantastic meditation teacher, was that she always talked to Jesus as an intimate, which meant, like many of the great bhaktas, that she would yell at him and rage at him and scold him. And, you know, one of her great quotes was how, from a time when she was on a trip with some of her companion nuns, their cart overturned on a country road and they were stranded. And as they sat there trying to get the wheel off the car, back on the cart, she said to Jesus, "Lord, if this is the way you treat your friends, it's a wonder that you have any." So this is bhakti. You know, it's an intimacy with the divine beloved that nothing can erase. So what Teresa used to pray and what so many of us have learned to pray is something like this. You know, I see this veil. I see this negative pattern. I see this little speck of darkness in myself. I can't make it go away on my own. Please take it from me. I offer it to you. Please free me from it. And as that prayer matures, it becomes more open-ended. And very much like Krishna's final instructions to Arjuna, you know, I offer myself to you with all my positive and negative qualities. Please make me what I need to be in order to live in love. I give you permission to transform you. And in my case, I usually ask, please make it a little bit gentle. So close your eyes and let's make that prayer. St. Teresa's prayer in your own words. Whatever in me is opposed to the inner transformation that love is bringing forth, I offer that. I offer it into the fire of your love. I offer it into the fire of your transformation. I offer myself with all my beautiful qualities and all my flaws. I offer myself to you. Please transform my half-hearted devotion into full body surrender. And if that's too much for you, please allow me to feel your presence all the time. You know, one of the things I want to say about Teresa and her, you know, her quarrel with God, this is the way you treat your friends, it's a wonder you still have any. This is actually not petulance. It comes from a recognition of something that Krishna says in the Gita. Krishna says, when a person is devoted to me, I take care of what he has and secure for him whatever he needs. You know, he's talking here specifically about your worldly life, but that point seems to be a major piece of all the devotional traditions. You know, in Jesus' words, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all else will be added unto you. In other words, it's going to be all right, no matter what. And though Jesus himself died for his total commitment to love, it was all right with him too. But for those of us on the path, for those of us who are walking in slow steps, that ultimate sacrifice is not required until the moment when it is. And there is a moment when it is, not that you die on the cross, but that you actually begin to be willing to let your small self go. When you actually become willing to enter into the great love. We'll talk about that in a minute. But in the meantime, on the journey, you know, Tukaram always said, Tukaram is really my favorite of the intimate bhaktas of Krishna. He always said, who else are you going to ask? He always would say, I love you. Take care of me. So what this means is that, you know, since our karmic situation as well as our receptivity to grace means that you're going to experience this truth in your own way, and sometimes so subtly that you don't really know that God is taking care of you till you look back and discern the pattern. And one of my friends tells this story, this very sweet story. He's always felt unattractive. And at a certain point, and this was after some years on the path, he realized that people, more and more people were telling him he was handsome. and more people were interested in dating him, which was something that was important to him. And he realized that this development was actually the fulfillment of a wish that he had carried without being fully ready to admit that he carried it. And it took a long time and a lot of, because very often, you know, at certain moments in the path, our bodies can become quite beautiful, even if we're old, or even if we're, you know, skinny or fat or whatever in our bodies doesn't comport with the current standards of beauty. But the inner beauty starts to shine through us. And in the same way, the inner abundance starts to show up in our lives. So all of these experiences may seem very small, especially compared to having a full-blown download of ecstasy, but they are also life-changing, and they're part of the promise of this journey. So, you know, you may remember that poem that was so famous in the 80s about the woman who dreams that she's walking down a beach and she sees that there are footsteps walking along with her, and she realizes that these are the footsteps of Jesus. And then she notices that there is a stretch where only one set of footprints is there, and she asks, and she realizes that this is one of the very hard times in her life. And she asks, why did you abandon me at this time when I was in so much pain? And at this point, she hears a voice that says, the reason you only saw one set of footprints was because that was the time I was carrying you. So that story, you know, which people printed on, you know, wood carved into pieces of wood and hung on their walls, and which is still one of the most beautiful truths about how the bhakti path is. So again, breathe in and out of the heart. Ask to be shown the moments of love that came up in your life today, whether as your own feelings or as someone's smile or an animal or a tree kindled a moment of love. Notice that maybe you didn't really notice it, because maybe it wasn't what you thought love should look like in that moment. But without thinking about it too much, just look at your day and recognize how those moments of love showed up. You know, maybe somebody was annoyed with you and you were able not to be reactive. Or maybe you got a call from an old friend whom you haven't seen in a long time. Or maybe you just had a great moment sitting on your terrace or at your dining room table drinking a cup of tea. Just let yourself receive the memory of those moments as if you were gathering up the particles of love that thread through your life. You know, one of the things that I love so much about the listserv and about having known so many of you over the years is that I've read your posts and, you know, heard your stories about times in your life which were really, really difficult, and there's quite a few of them coming through the listserv on this journey. But the thing that I think we all see about each other in these communications is that with, you know, the health challenges, the family challenges, the tough karma, the loss, the emotional suffering, the depression, the overwhelm, the feelings of failure, that at some point every one of us realizes that there is this thread that makes you remember love. This moment when the veil lifts, maybe only a moment for a moment, but making such a difference, shining in your life like a beacon of truth, that as one of my teachers once said, allows you to remember love, even in the midst of pain. And this is bhakti. This is Krishna fulfilling his promise. And for so many of you, these qualities have started or continue to penetrate these veils. And you recognize that no matter how it looks, no matter how close or distant you feel from love, the beloved is what you've always wanted. And there's something about having that recognition, even if it's only for 10 minutes, that opens the door to realizing that you are love and love is you. So the Bhakti Sutras are above all aspirational. You know, sometimes when I read texts like this, I go, oh my God, this is so exalted. You know, this is so above my pay grade. And then I realize it, basically what the sage wants us to know, what Narada wants us to know, is that this possibility is waiting for us. And that, you know, even if personal devotion doesn't feel like your path, that nonetheless these generous practices, the practices of bhakti, will sweeten whatever path you follow. So mantra, prayer, offering your work, noticing when you're out of sorts and finding a way to return to the awareness that love is present even when you don't feel it. You know, asking, is there any love presence? Practicing with the mantra. Sometimes just asking, is there any love present, is enough to unleash the force of it, as Annabelle wrote to the listserv yesterday. So I want to talk a little bit about prayer, because just as mantra, many of the sages say mantra is a cash practice. You know, you say, you don't have to wait. You do have a practice. You do have to practice a bit before it becomes a cash practice for you. But if you're willing to give some time and energy to mantra, eventually you do get to the point where the mantra is soothing your heart, lifting your spirits, turning you inside, pretty much, you know, 3 to 5 minutes after you start repeating it. So prayer is like that too. And there are many ways to pray. There's, you know, it just, but as Anne Lamott writes, direct prayer, the practice of addressing spirit, comes down to three: wow, thank you, and help. And, you know, there's also the powerful Christian practice of contemplative prayer, where you cultivate a sense of divine presence and just stay in it. But I feel that that's meditation by another name. So what we're going to talk about is classic petitionary prayer, you know, where you actually talk to God, talk to your soul, talk to the trees, talk to the ocean. So, and here's the thing about prayer. The whole heart of prayer is the acknowledgement that there's something profoundly personal in the universe, something that responds to us. And of course, from a non-dual point of view, you could say it's the innate intelligence, and it's true. The awareness, it's the subtlest level of existence. That awareness responds, hears, pays attention. And since the nature of reality is loving, that awareness is basically ready to give you what you want if circumstances allow. And, you know, of course, that if circumstances allow clause is the catch-22 of personal prayer. But that's a different conversation. What we want to talk about is prayer as a practice, prayer as a way of tuning in to the divine, and also as a way of praying such that a shift occurs. So when you pray, it is particularly effective to center your prayer on a particular node of that vast divinity. In other words, to give the divine a name, whatever name you want. You know, formal bhakti practice, especially prayer practice, is more than often, usually addressed to a particular aspect of spirit. That's why it's helpful to have a specific form of spirit that you cultivate relationship with. But it's not necessary. You can just talk to spirit. You know, but in choosing a form to connect to, or in choosing to relate to the all-pervading spirit, it's very helpful if you have a felt sense of attraction or familiarity with a particular way of addressing the divine. Again, it doesn't have to be God or Krishna or Jesus or Buddha. But that said, if the great deity forms are powerful vortexes of energy with their own unique energetic signature, and if you have an inclination towards such a form, and especially if you believe that it is real, that spirit is real, it will sooner or later come alive for you. So that's the second key, to center your prayer on a particular aspect or taste of spirit, and the second is to really feel that it's real. There's an Indian folk tale about an old woman who had a statue of Ram on her altar, and she would offer incense to it every day and say mantras. And this went on for years, but she never felt any response. She never felt any sense of presence or love. And she certainly never got her prayers answered. So finally she got fed up, and she went out and bought a statue of Krishna and set Krishna up with his own altar on the other side of the room. And one day, as she was about to light a stick of incense to offer Krishna, she realized that the smoke of the incense could travel to the Ram statue, and she didn't want Ram. She didn't want this statue to experience any of the fragrance. So she went over to the statue, took a rag, and stuffed the rag up the nose of the statue of Ram. And then as she was waving the incense at the Krishna statue, she heard a noise behind her, and she turned. She saw that the Ram statue had come alive and was laughing at her. And she said, "What the hell? For so many years I worshipped you, and you never showed up for me. And now that I've abandoned you, you come?" And Ram said, "All these years you were worshipping a statue. You never thought that I was alive in it. Today was the first time you treated me as if I was real." So that's what makes prayer effective. You need to feel that you're talking to someone real, no matter how formless. The name we call on, again, might be a particular teacher, might be a deity. We've been practicing with the name Beloved, and that works for me, but that may not be resonant for you. So just take a moment and tune into the name, the form that feels most meaningful to you at this moment. And again, it doesn't have to be a particular deity or being. But for prayer, you want to make a commitment for now to experience the divine in this particular form. And I want to explain a little bit about how I've found that this practice works and the different phases of it, and then I'll lead you through a process. So how are you going to conceive of this presence that you're praying to? You know, you might feel that it's in front of you or around you, simply surrounding you like a field of grace. You may actually create a visualization, or you might tune into your heart and sense presence in your heart. So, at some point in the practice, you'll actually, no matter how you're invoking spirit, you're going to start to tune into the feeling in your heart, the felt sense in your heart. You know, traditionally, the Ishta Devata, the personal deity form, is found in the heart. Doesn't have to have a shape or color. Might manifest as a light. But at least in my experience, more often as a feeling, as a felt sensation, a felt presence. And there is a certain point where trying to visualize your inner divinity in form can feel like an obstacle to true recognition of the beloved inside. In other words, even if you're meditating on a form, the form is going to dissolve. But there are times in your life when having a particular deity as an other, as a separate being, is intensely comforting, and that is very much a part of the preliminary practices of bhakti. So, you know, it's very powerful to be able to say, please awaken my heart, please take this obstacle away, please help me forgive this person, with the feeling that there is somebody, not you, who's in relationship to you and whom you can put matters in, you know, and feel that you can put matters in their hands so that you're not caught in that, you know, that sense of I'm responsible for all this that is important in many aspects of life, but not in prayer practice. The othering of spirit is like having an invisible friend, you know, or an invisible parent, or an invisible lover. But when the form begins to dissolve, don't try to bring it back. Just let the dissolution happen, because that's the correct, as it were. No, correct is not a word we want to use when we talk about prayer practice. That's the inevitable and natural end point of a prayer practice, is that which you're praying to dissolves into you. So there are five parts to this practice. First, you center yourself with the breath of the heart. Second, you invite or invoke the beloved, finding a name that connects, and asking, please be with me, hear me, I'm here, wanting to feel your presence. And you might do this by imagining the presence in front of you. Or by giving that presence a seat inside your heart. The third part of the prayer is just saying thank you, the gratitude part. Thank you for being alive. Thank you for my body working. Thank you for everything that allows me to live my life. Thank you for the love I experience from people. Thank you for the struggles that help me grow. And then the fourth part is the petitionary part, asking for what you need, for what's close to your heart, for what you want help with. And as you do this, for a lot of us, there might be some hesitation. You know, maybe it's not okay to ask for this particular thing, or maybe I shouldn't be doing asking at all. Maybe I should be doing the, you know, new thought practice of affirmation. I am fully alive in love and presence, and I'm so grateful. So, but in this particular practice, we're going to do it by asking. We're going to take the bhava, the attitude that the divine is your mother, your father, your lover, and that you're asking for help, and that help is going to come. It's a very humble posture. And I've found, as many of you have, that it's the one that invites surrender. And then the fifth part is at the end of the prayer, you rest. So find your posture and let yourself be comfortable. We'll start with 5 slow, deep breaths. And you might want to do it feeling that the breath flows directly into the heart as if there's an opening in the chest or a nose in the chest. And let yourself feel the energy of breath beginning to soften and open the space of the heart. Now feel that there is a presence sitting very near you, right in front of you, very close, so close that you don't have to shout, you can just whisper. And begin to call the name. Or you can say, I don't know what name to call you, so I'm just going to call you love. I know you're the deepest truth. I know you're the source of all the love I can feel. I'm asking you to be here. Your feeling, your bhava, is I'm fully here. I invite you to be here with me. And as soon as you feel that sense of presence, even very slightly, begin to say thank you. And as you say thank you, see if you can feel all the ways in which life sustains and supports you. Now say what you would like to say. If you want to complain, complain. If you want to pour out your heart, pour out your heart. If you want to present a problem, do that. If there's a question you want to ask, ask it. Really let yourself speak, be in conversation, and you can do it out loud. You're in your own space. And gradually in the conversation, begin to lay before the Beloved your request for what you feel you need right now, in this moment, in this time in your life, what you feel you need. Feel that you're essentially throwing yourself in the Beloved's mercy. Ask for material things. Ask for inner transformation. Ask for help for someone you love. Ask for understanding. Ask to be able to let go of obstacles. Ask to deepen your love. Ask for whatever you want and need without any feeling that some of it is more important and better and more spiritual than any of the rest of it. Notice that there will be a particular moment when you feel that your prayer has been heard, where it's almost like something clicks. And at that moment, just let yourself rest. Let yourself be present. Let yourself feel the connection and breathe the presence of the Beloved into your heart. Breathing it in and breathing it out. The passion for sacred intimacy is one of the deepest urges in the human soul, actually probably the deepest. It's that passion that makes us seek another person. And when we find that intimacy on a deep level, it can feel like the reason we were born, and it is. In the Bhakti Sutras, in verse 65, Narada says, "Dedicate all your actions to God and direct all your passions, such as lust, anger, pride, towards spirit." And the paradox here is that as we do that, what we discover is that we are loved no matter what. We said earlier, you've been given an empowerment, and that will be with you for a really long time. And sometimes it is really enough just to ask, is there any love present, to remember it. In the mystical traditions, the culmination of the journey of love is sometimes called union. By the Sufis, it's called fana, the dying of the individual separate self into love itself. But what the greatest mystics of love understand is that the end of the path isn't dissolution. It's the full integration of lover, beloved, and love itself, which makes an integrated a love body within us. You know, this practice of inhaling up to the third eye and then stretching that sense of presence down to the heart is actually one of the first steps in beginning to discover this inner body, this mystical body, which is really the body of love. And it's when this sense of the presence within us, of a realm, of a seat, of a container, which we can enter and feel our connection to the beloved, to our own deepest wisdom, and to the deepest wisdom of the universe, it's that which is the transformative gift really of every form of mystical yoga. So we've done many practices here, some of them quite dramatic, some of them very simple. I wish we could have spent a few hours every week chanting together, but that's going to have to wait for an in-person retreat. As always, when love is the topic, it's been a roller coaster. The company of enlightened bhaktas like Rumi and Kabir and Ramakrishna is very, very strong. Their transmission has been poured into us. And it's literally drawing us towards their attainment, their state. So in the Bhakti Sutra, Narada gives us a couple of pieces of very choice advice. First of all, he says, teachings on bhakti should be reflected on. Teachings that awaken it should be undertaken. And then he says, all other forms of devotion are surpassed. When the self offers devotion as a constant servant or a constant lover, one should act out of love. Truly, one should act out of love. So that's what we're learning to do. We're learning to clear away everything that stands in the way of being so in touch with the beloved in the heart that we act out of love without even knowing that that's what we're doing. To act out of love, of course, we do have to give love to the unloved and unloving parts of ourselves, and we have to do that relentlessly. And that's really what these practices are about. They're about kindling that feeling, giving it to ourselves first, whether in the form of our own heart or in the form of the deity whom we connect it with, and recognizing that all the ways we love, even the most veiled, if we recognize what we love when we love, every connection can begin to melt the veils. So if love feels like too big a word, just substitute another word: affection, appreciation, tenderness, softness. All of these are flavors of love. So here's the bottom line. Spirit is real. Spirit is love. It permeates everything, and the insides of this world are lined with it. That love wants to be known by us. And its essence is a sweetness that cannot be described. One of Narada's most famous verses, he says, "The essential nature of love cannot be expressed in words. It is like a mute person trying to describe flavor." That love reveals itself when you're ready. It is free of limiting qualities, free of self-centered desire, ever expanding, uninterrupted, most subtle of the nature of inner experience. Achieving that experience, one sees only love, speaks only love, and thinks of love alone. So, in your homework, I'll give you a list of the practices that I think are really the gold star bhakti practices, especially the two we started with. Is there any love presence? Feeling love coming towards you, breathing love from the universe and breathing it back. And then all the specific practices, inner beloved practice, deity practice, practicing with the inner stream of the breath in the Ajna Chakra and the heart. Committing to noticing your obstructions and letting it go. Mantra, whether it's a Sanskrit mantra or a statement like, "I let go of everything that is not love." Or, "I am worthy to receive the highest and deepest form of love," or whatever opens your heart. And above all, let yourself receive love and let yourself recognize that you are love. I want to read a poem which is an expression of the ecstasy of an enlightened bhakta. It's one of Rumi's poems. And it really reveals the way in which the dualism of devotion to a beloved other turns into the absolute non-duality of recognizing that the beloved is you. Rumi says, "I am not Christian, Jew, pagan, Muslim. I am not of east nor west, land nor sea. I am not of nature nor of spirit. I am not of earth, of water, of air, of fire. I am not of India, of China, of Bulgaria, I am not of Iraq nor of Khorasan. I am not of this world nor of the next world. I am without body and soul, for he is one only, beloved, first and last, inward and outward. And I cry one, and I cry he is. I drained this cup. There is nothing now but ecstatic annihilation. Were I ever other than this, I regret being born. If forever it is this, I'll trample both worlds and dance ecstatic forever. So this is our lineage, this is our promise. No matter how far we may feel from this at any moment, at any given moment, this is our reality. In the end, we tire of everything except the great love. So thank you so much. Please, please remember we have another week. We're going to have homework and practice and the listserv. And if there are questions that haven't been answered, please feel free to write to the listserv and write to me. Thank you, Deb, so much for everything you do to hold us. And again, thank you all for everything you bring to this Sangam. Have a beautiful rest of your day or your evening. For some of you, it's very early in the morning. For some of you, pretty late at night. I love you. Love is with you. Be in love. Namaste.